question I had before I watched the film.
Uh-huh.
Why remake?
Yeah.
Because it was successful the first time around. How do you approach it, since there is the other version?
Yes, the other one. And, well, we all asked that question. And Neil Simon's first response was, why not? And he said they revive Streetcar Named Desire. They revive all these, you know, serious plays, Long Day's Journey and Tonight, even comedies, Kaufman and Hart. And so it's sort of like a play anyway. And what would happen if a whole new cast was in it and it was set in today? And whenever he asks me to do something, I cannot resist, because one, the stuff is so beautifully written, and the other, it's working with him, which is just a treat. And so I thought originally you should only remake flops. You should not remake hits. But in this case, I changed my whole philosophy overnight, because I said this thing is worth doing. And the story is universal. I mean, 10, 15 years from now, it'll be the same. You know, there'll be a woman and a kid, and someone will walk out on her, and a guy will come to New York, an actor, to try and make it and fall in love. It's a universal story. And also, his structure is so beautiful. It's so, you rarely see scripts like this.
Did you think the semantic issue, because I called it a remake, but you used the word revival, and I guess that is unfair, that when you bring back a play, it's a revival.
Yeah.
Yeah,
well, and remake, you know, it's kind of like we're not really remaking it, because we're not changing very much. We just say that was 1977, and I've shot this in a different way than Herb Ross did, and he did, of course, a great job. I mean, they won Academy Awards. And we're in 2003, going into 2004, and so there's a different thing in the air here. And I think it affects everything. Well, there's a whole audience who hasn't seen the other picture, you know. Our actors are different than the original actors. They're just different people. And the relationship, the balance is different in this, I think, than in the first one. Because it's kind of an adult relationship in this. And Jeff is a real leading man, and it changes the dynamics in it. And just the fact that you're passing through, you know, two other wonderful comic actors makes it contemporary, because they're contemporary right here now. And the other thing that meant something to me was, you know, it puts a serious point on it, but I don't, it is serious, is that this is a New York story. And in 77, there was a certain sense, well, a lot of things, but of innocence in a way, although we had Vietnam and all, and that. And here we had 9/11, you know, which there's no way to come to grips with that. But New York is even better now in the way people are treating each other. And I thought, innocence has to keep going on. They have to keep coming and trying to make it in that city. That's what that city is about. And they come, you know, with a smile on their face and hope, even in the face of what's happened. They still come with that kind of thing. Can I make it here? Not just in the theater, but everywhere. And nothing can stop that. And so I thought, it's right for New York to have another innocence, you know, to present itself. So that was part of it.
Was Patricia Hart again for this?
No, she wanted to do it, I have to say, right from the beginning. And, you know, here's another thing. Both Neil and I feel the same way. When we ask someone to do something, the ones who say, what? Yep. I'm there. It's Neil Simon. I'm there. You just want those people. That's the ones you want. The ones that say, oh, well, I like to think about it a little while, and I don't know, and could you change something in Act Two? You know, saying, oh, okay, we got someone we're dragging into this. You want someone there with total enthusiasm who's, you know, just loves the idea and wants to do it. And that's how she responded, and Jeff the same way. That's who you want to work with.
I love the casting of Alan Cummings.
Yeah, yeah. I only knew that's who I wanted. I didn't know him, and now I know him, and he's, of course, this terrific guy. And no, and you know, TNT has been so great about this because there wasn't the budget for that part was not there to get someone like Alan Cumming. But as soon as we said to them, you know, he likes this and wants to do it, they stepped up to that. They recognized, too, that what a great thing it would be to have an actor like that. In there. So when I think it was Nancy Foy, who was my casting lady, said, you know, why don't you think about Alan Cumming as an old boy? You know?
As you get older, is the process of movie making still fun for you?
Yeah, it is. It is. You know, it's hard. I mean, it's hard. It's an athletic event and a mind-brain thing at the same time. But I really enjoy it. You're at the center of a hurricane, and it's got a weird calmness in the center. But you're doing something you like so much that it energizes me, you know? It is. But I'll tell you, it's painful when, you know, the script is not working. And then it's painful because you still have to do all the same work, and you know you're trying to make this thing work and something's not working and you're trying to fix it or whatever. And then when you get something like this, it's such a joy that you say, now I remember why I'm doing this. Yeah.
I think that's an interesting comment because I have a pet theory that no one ever sets out to make a bad movie.
No.
Mm. You have to realize when it's going south. And it does make me wonder why somebody doesn't say, hey, let's stop, let's shut it down, rewrite it, do whatever.
That's exactly what happened with The Goodbye Girl. What you're saying exactly happened with The Goodbye Girl. Originally, there was a movie called Bogart Slept Here with Robert De Niro and I forget who else. And Mike Nichols was directing it. And they knew it wasn't working. And they stopped it. Which takes tremendous courage because money has been spent and you kind of think, well, we'll get through it somehow and maybe we can fix this and make it work. And they stopped. They were actually shooting. It's so interesting you say that because here it is related to this movie. And that was that. And then Neil took some elements in that and remade it into this movie. Reworked it completely into this movie. He went away, I think to Italy or somewhere on a vacation with Marcia Mason, who was his wife at the time, and wrote a romantic comedy, but based on some elements of Bogart Slept Here. It's exactly what. But you've got to be strong to be able to do that because it's a train that's moving, and it's a fast, big train. And it's on these tracks that have already been paid for, you know, and to say, guess what? We're taking the railroad apart. You know, we're taking all the tracks are coming out. Everything's coming out. We're not going to. That takes a lot. Yes, I think it's harder. So much has been put into place, so much tie-ins and promotions and corporate things are involved in some of these big pictures that to stop them, you would be stopping more than a train. You'd be stopping a business, you know? And yes, it's really hard. You don't get that chance to try it out, do you know? And fail. I mean, the Marx Brothers took their movies out and did them as plays, and so they could see what was really happening there. You can have rehearsals and stuff like that. But once you've engaged huge stars, who have just this window in their schedule, you know, and you say, "My God, we got so and so. It's a green light. We're going. How's the script? We're working on it. You know, but." so-and-so's in it, you know, wow, you know, wow what? That's how it happens. I always, you know, think of this thing when someone calls and says, there's a movie and we're going to Paris. Really? Paris, France? Yeah. How's the script? Paris. We're all going to Paris, France. You know, it's, you know, the food's great. How is the script? It'll be 3 weeks, 3 months in Paris, you know? Okay, you know, the script's got to be there first. It's got to be there first.
What about Katie? I mean, I think we all interviewed her when she was like 5 years old.
Oh, Hallie? Hallie Kate. Yeah, Hallie Kate, yeah.
And she talked about she was like 18 at then.
Right, so now she's 30, right. I know it. It's incredible. She's incredible. And, you know, I read and read girls. I read some good ones. But, you know, some of them were from, like, Kansas or Alabama or something. They didn't have that New York East thing. And then Hallie put herself on tape. Her mother taped her. You know, they did it in their house somewhere or something. And I got that tape, and I said, whoa. And I went with that tape with our casting director, Nancy Ford, over to Neil's house, and I put the tape in. And she said about, I don't know, 6 words. He said, her. Get her. You know, so that's how that happened. And she's great, smart kid and a real kid. You know, she's not like an actor kid, although she's a wonderful actress and parents are great. Yeah.
I remember the first time we interviewed her, and she just charmed the whole room. And then a couple of years later, we had another interview session, and I repeated something to her that she had said at that interview.
Uh-huh.
And she put her hands on her head. I think she must have been all of 8 years. Mm-hmm. Since then, and you remember something I said.
Yeah, yeah. She's quite something.
You talked with such admiration of Neil Simon's structure. There's also what I think is the challenge of Neil Simon's dialogue, because it is so clever that I think there's the risk of it being too clever, because no one can think that quickly.
No.
The perfect quip.
Right. And in that is the thing that these actors, that Jeff and Patty and Hallie and everybody, you cannot improvise. You can't put actor handles on these lines. You can't say listen in front of it, or look, or see, or okay. You can't do any of that, because the rhythm is so structured and so set and perfect that you can't mess with it. So you have to learn them, you know, backwards and forwards, up and down. So then, within it, your mind can play in it. You can think, when she says that, it isn't that you're just saying this smart line back. It's, I've come up with this smart line. Neil told me one time, he was watching the original production in the theater of Barefoot in the Park, and that was Robert Redford and Elizabeth Ashley, and he was behind some people, and Elizabeth Ashley said something, and then Redford came back with something, and then as she says, I mean, he came back, and this woman leaned, she said, that Robert Redford is so smart. You know, and he said, you know, okay, I give up. You know, do you know? So, yes, you've got to get underneath all of those lines and you know, make them real and everything. Also, it does another really great thing. It makes you as quick. It makes the audience as smart and as quick. You know, it's like when, you know, that's why I don't believe in any of this, you know, the audience can't handle this or that. They're as smart as everybody. And we're all the same. And when you do Shaw or Shakespeare in front of them, they get quick and smart with all of that. If you dumb it down, then they behave that way, you know. Yeah, he rewrote it, but it's almost everything is very, very close and the same. But he did write out every single line, so there's some kind of changes in rhythms and things like that. But he did. But he wrote it out in longhand on a yellow pad. So it's not really a rewrite. He just I'm saying he rewrote it.
Right, he worked on it again.
Yes. Yeah, but he rewrote it on paper. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Thinking about the Alan Cumming character, and thinking of also in the original 25 years ago when it was originally presented,
mm-hmm.
the whole element of being gay and gay culture, mm-hmm. part of American still a little bit of a...
Yes.
A more shocking.
Yeah.
Certainly
than
today.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
So did you think about that just in terms of how to present that?
The only thing we added, and I asked Neil for this, and he put this in, was the line when he says, let's face it, Richard III was gay. And then Jeff says, well, I don't think that's any of our business. That may be personal, but what does that got to do with it? And the other one where he says about many of my friends in the theater are, gay, and they're going to crucify me for this. You know, don't let me hang out there. Those were the only kind of concessions to it. But other than that, we pretty well did the same thing based on this director's perception of this. And then what was most interesting to me is you see the whole reason my mother loves it, she loves it, you know, that was the whole reason for doing this entire, you know, production, whatever his relationship is, you know, with her. But yeah, no, I thought about all that, but I don't know what the substitute would have been in there. Yeah, and Jeff said, how far are we going? You know, he says to him, how far do you want me to go? And he said, be bold. And he said to me, how far? And I said, well, it's a line. You know, we're walking a line here. And he saw the costume. He said, oh, forget it. Let's just do it.
Do you get more directing offers?
Yeah, I do. I like... my wife and I did a play in New York about 2 years ago, and I love it doing it. There's nothing like it, especially in New York in the theater. I mean, it's, you know, that's a test. And I don't like not doing it because I like being in touch with all of that. But acting is hard. Acting is really hard. And, you know, my hat goes off to, like, Jeff and Patty and everyone. But I like the direct. That's what I wanted to do in the first place, and I like being involved in everything. I like controlling everything, being involved in everything, and all of that. So sometimes I don't feel that in the acting, you know, you work a few months of the year or something like that. I like what it takes to do these things.
It doesn't get easy in the acting career.
No, it doesn't. Still, you are pulling on some place that, you know, is even in whether it's serious or comedy or whatever, to get it right, you're pulling in the same, pulling it out of yourself, you know, to do it. And I never feel that it's easy to do.
Mm-mm. You're out of time, guys.
Oh. Nope.
Thank you.
Oh, sure. Just sign it?
Yeah.
Okay, sure.
What? Can I get one more question? That's fine.
I was thinking going back to the beginnings of your acting career, which was sort of coincided with the era that we now look back on with such nostalgia.
Mm-hmm.
Great films were coming out of the studios then. Things being said that don't come out of the studios today. Have you reflected back on why? Well, what changed that we don't get those voices?
Well, I know what changed. It's television. And what it is television advertising. I've got this entire theory completely worked out. There you opened in a few theaters, you had some ads in some newspapers, and you stayed in those theaters, six cities or whatever it was, for how many months or whatever, and the word of mouth or whatever it built, and then it went out in the second run and all of that. Today, you have the opening weekend, and the opening weekend is mostly based on television advertising, which means in television advertising, you have to reach the most people, which relates to Thursday night, which relates to NBC, blah, 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 of what shows they have to deliver on, and it costs the most to advertise on NBC on Thursday night, which is why they want to retain whatever friends and whatever is working for them on Thursday. Because that's the heaviest movie advertising the day before these movies open. As movie campaigns build on television, they peak on that day before. So you have to reach the most people. So you have to make a movie that justifies that, which puts it in the middle somewhere, and that's where The middle is neither, you know, high or low or whatever, except in some of the special films, you know, that, you know, then you'll get a miracle like Shakespeare in Love or something with an incredible screenplay, but took years to get made or whatever. So, but generally you'll get that middle thing because it's got to pay back all of that. So that's my own little special theory. You know, and before that, you were in a few theaters, and you had some newspaper advertising and reviews and stuff like that, and you hung in there, and if the word of mouth built, you started to go out to other theaters and things like that. It wasn't the competition of television. It was the use of television in advertising that made you reach them. Then you were in 3,000 screens, you know, so you got to pay off on that weekend and everything, so the business, became that.
Quick.
Thank you.
Thanks, thank you.